This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Sex is one of the most fundamental forces in the history of life on Earth. And according to our next guest, most of what we think we know about it is wrong, or at least embarrassingly incomplete. For example, whiptail lizards and California condors can reproduce without a mate. Clownfish can permanently change sex. Slime molds don't bother with two sexes. They have hundreds. The natural world is wildly, gloriously unconstrained by our tidy categories.
Dr. Li Xing Sun is a distinguished research professor of biological sciences at Central Washington University, a Harvard Radcliffe Fellow, and the author of the new book On the Origin of Sex, The Weird and Wonderful Science of Reproduction. He has spent decades studying sexual reproduction and evolution, and he brings all that to bear on one of biology's oldest and most stubbornly unresolved questions. Why does sex exist in the first place? The answers, as Dr. Sun reveals, are stranger and more fascinating than anyone expected. Dr. Li Xing Sun, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much, Scott and Lynn.
So, Dr. Sun, Darwin obviously gave us the origin of species, and now you're tackling the origin of sex. Why is that the question? Why sexual reproduction exists at all? It's still contested among biologists all this time? Seriously, still?
Yeah, that's actually well misunderstood. The origin of sex is still a very debated issue in science, but we are getting there in recent years because of the biological, technological development in biology. We have known a lot of people working on it from theoretical perspective and from empirical perspective as well, and they are not easy questions to answer. But we do have a consensus that sex is not really for reproduction, because asexual reproduction is faster and more efficient. Sexual reproduction is only, at most, only half of it. So sex was not for reproduction. Turned out to be sex is for generating a diversity, for mixing genes. So that's something not everybody knows.
So it seems like sex is just a bad deal. I mean, you're only passing on half your genes. It takes two individuals, and it's energetically expensive. And so what's the standard argument for why natural selection favored it anyway? And why does that argument fall so short?
For sex as to become dominant, one of the main reasons is as we understand now, is that sex creates some new genetic combinations. If you have asexual reproduction, which we call it virgin birth or cloning, you ended up with be all the offspring would have the same genetic makeup. The problem is genetic mutations, everything there would accumulate. So eventually they will degenerate to a degree that the lineage will no longer carry on. So that is the point that, well, the entire lineage will go extinct. And this idea is known as the Mulus Ratchet. Was after named after the person, after the geneticist by the name of Hermann Joseph Mueller, who won the Nobel Prize for mutational studies. But that was actually mild, as we realized. There is another reason for sex to evolve, to occur. That reason was organisms normally suffer the breaks in their DNA. Often the double breaks in DNA cannot be repaired unless there's sexual reproduction. So apparently lots of biologists now agree that sex probably originated from the need to repair the double break DNA and then began to be used for something else, sort of like a readapted for something else.
It is very complex, Li Xing, and I think it's so interesting. I think any of us lay people would say, well, of course, sex is about procreation, reproduction, and continuation of the species. How long has there been sort of common knowledge surrounding the fact that sex really is to fix the imperfections, repair the double break in the DNA.
That idea is fairly new in only a few decades, but the Müller's ratchet has been around since the 1960s. So it's slightly more than about six decades. Müller's ratchet has been proposed by Müller in the 1960s. And then people realized probably that Müller's ratchet is not powerful enough because it's too slow. Sort of like your computer, if you don't clean it, these malware, these viruses accumulate until your computer cannot run. But that's a slow process. Recently, people realize, wow, there are other major problems. The DNA molecules are regularly broken by radiation and some other environmental chemicals, something like that. And in that case, especially double breaks, they cannot be repaired until sex is around. So now more and more people tend to agree that, well, that probably was the beginning of sex. And then once sex is there, it can be used for many different things. So that is the beginning of the biodiversity under the evolution of sex.
Mm. Well, sex is much more magical than most people ever knew. Then, you know, it seems like we have stopped hearing about cloning. I remember when they had cloned, you know, a sheep. And it seems like maybe that was 15 or 20 years ago, but you don't hear much about it anymore. Is this why, that if we continue just cloning species, that it would lead to their own demise?
Yeah, cloning has its own problems. These are the Dolly the sheep, which is very famous. Yeah. They not live that long. There are problems with cloning that have just been understood. So there are many issues involved with cloning, but one of the main issue is that, well, you don't have genetic diversity, and eventually it will die out. And naturally, it does happen in lots of species. So now we see cloning is efficient, but it lacks genetic diversity. Sex is inefficient, but it has genetic diversity. So a better solution is to, yeah, when possible, you can clone, and then you switch to sexual reproduction when the conditions are not good, when genetic diversity is needed. So there are many species like that, such as aphids in your backyards, such as water fleas in the water. These are often used as fish food. And they do these things during the good time. They just clone themselves and make lots of them. But when time gets bad and they revert to sexual reproduction while generating the genetic diversity. So it seems to be a perfect solution, but the strategy itself also has some problems as well.
Well, Dr. Sun, with all due respect, you're kind of taking the romantic version of sexual reproduction out of the conversation, but I guess I get it because, I mean, if it's just so, I guess, energetically expensive, it seems that self-reproduction, as I think we're kind of talking a little bit about, is maybe more efficient. So let's talk about some of the stranger examples in your book. So example, slime molds with hundreds of mating types, algae where nearly anyone can mate with anyone else. What do these organisms tell us about, you know, the deep origins of sex? And do we need
it? These are we call the mating types because they only produce one type of gametes. We produce two types, mainly two types of the sperm versus eggs, but they only have one because they are of the same size. So by strict biological definition, they are unisexual. So this is interesting. It's just totally different from what we often call unisexual, but they are truly unisexual. Only produce one type of gametes, but these gametes carry different genes. They tend to merge with gametes with different genes so as to avoid, apparently avoiding inbreeding. So now you have different mating types each has its own genetic makeup. So you can have 2, 3, or even 23 so far, 23,000 so far we know. So in that kind of situation, we still don't know much about why they have that many, but it is possible for them to sort of like perpetuate that kind of mating type by mating with different individuals with different genetic makeup.
Wow. Okay. So with 23,000 different mating types, I'm sure it's hard to pick out an anniversary card. when I was a younger man, I owned for many years a saltwater aquarium, saltwater tank. And one of my very favorite things in my tank were my clownfish. And I was surprised to find out in your book that clownfish can actually permanently change sex, and bearded dragons undergo temperature-dependent sex reversal. What do these cases reveal about how fluid biological sex activity across the animal kingdom? What does it tell us when we have these kind of reversals occurring in nature?
So sex is something to be tweaked, which means they adapt to situations. So they are feature of adaptation. So sort of like in cases that when in clownfish, for example, the females, well, clownfish typically live in small social groups. The top one, the largest one, the dominant one is the female. Well, the rest are all males. So the beta fish is an adult male, while the rest are immature males. The reason being that the females have the highest reproductive success, which is everybody would desire to be. But you have to be dominant enough to be the female. So if the alpha female dies, then it would be beneficial for the beta male, which is adult, to turn into female so as to increase its genetic success. So that's the reason once the female kicks the bucket, suddenly the alpha male would replace the female to be females, or to be the female. And then the third one would turn from an immature male to be the male. So sort of like they are waiting in line to achieve to the highest reproductive success. And that is how evolution works on. And as to the temperature-dependent sex determination, that has been not only in beaded lizards, but the dragons, but also in lots of animals, especially reptiles, the crocodiles, and the turtles. For example, turtles often depending on the temperature. When temperature is high, they become all females. When temperature is low, they become all males. But for lizards, such as iguanas, it's low and high temperatures will produce females. So only in the middle, there will be males. So that has been worked out genetically in recent years, which is fascinating itself. But the evolutionary reason has not been adequately tested, except in only a few species.
Well, Li Qing, that is really fascinating. So let's look at the iguana. So you say that it becomes female when the temperature is higher and male when the temperature is lower. Is the reproduction taking place when it is female? And is that to say something about, I mean, iguanas are normally found in warm tropical areas, and so their existence may be more successful when it is hot instead of cold. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. Iguanas are not well known, but there is one species in Australia, in Tasmania. It's a skink. It's a small slippery lizards. It's just like a smaller lizards. It's a normal skink in Tasmania. And they live in the very low foothill of mountains to very high mountains. In high mountains, because the climate change or the weather changes radically, so they cannot adjust or bet on this temperature-dependent sex determination. The sexes all depend all dependent on chromosomes. it's a sort of genetic makeup. So there's no such a thing as temperature dependent sex determination. But in the lower foothills, while the weather is more predictable, so what happens is that starting with female would be a better strategy. So if a female lays eggs in the earlier time, or in these lizards, the eggs are hatched inside their body, which is nice. And most of these lizards tend to lay eggs outside, but these are a few species that lay eggs inside their body. So what happens is, if they start early in reproduction, if they hatch the female hatchlings, these female hatchlings will reproduce more than if they are males. So what happens is, if you give birth to early clutches of eggs and these baby lizards, it will be better for females to control them in a way to give birth to daughters, because daughters return more reproductive success. But in the later season, such as in the summer, what happens is they try to give birth to males so that, well, males will still be around, but their reproductive success is lower, but they still have some gain. So this is very interesting, but females actually can do that. Early in the spring, for example, the females can expose themselves under the sun, sort of do some bathing, and then they could turn the eggs inside their body into female babies. Cool. So this is kind of something that nobody would expect until the researchers found it.
Well, biology among these species is both fascinating and very flexible, which makes me wonder and worry a little bit about the reproductive success of humans. What does all this say to you about humans and why we seem to be a very successful species? Maybe we're not.
Well, we are successful enough. We are the most popular mammals on Earth. We have so much more body mass collectively than all the wildlife combined, although we are not diverse.
Right.
Yeah, but I think that we can take pride of that, being the most, in terms of biomass, we are the most successful species.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are in a fascinating conversation with Dr. Lixing Sun, whose new book on the origin of sex, the weird and wonderful science of reproduction, is telling us that maybe we don't know everything we thought we knew about sex and maybe why we even need it. I'd like to ask you a question a little bit about the Red Queen hypothesis. This is the idea that sex exists stay ahead of parasites in sort of like an evolutionary arms race. I'd love for you to maybe spend a little bit of time and tell us about this hypothesis.
Yeah, this Red Queen hypothesis is extremely important because we just don't know if sex is so important, why many species actually are using both? For example, sexual and asexual reproduction, they alternate. Sometimes they stay in asexual reproduction for a long period of time and turn out to be, well, the lots of species need sex to do something. And what is that something? And apparently, almost all species suffer parasites and pathogens. So the species have, all these species have the need to fight against them. How? If your genetic makeup is the same, the result will be, well, eventually you will not move on too far. But if you can diversify your genetic makeup, you have this genetic diversity to fight against these pathogens and parasites. We all know that. For example, when the North America was colonized, the Native Americans did not have the immunity, and they had this relatively genetic similarity, a lacking of this diversity to respond to the infectious diseases from Europe. So 90%, as we currently understand, died out. And the same thing as the in Europe as well during the Black Plague, during the plague, a third of Europeans died. I believe those that survived must have these higher immunity to the plague. So I think this genetic diversity, when parasites and pathogens are around and they are prevalent, the genetic diversity is critically important. So Red Queen sort of like telling us that, well, we have pathogens and parasites, but also you try to adapt to it. And then parasites and pathogens are also adapting to the hosts as well. So you have this arms race. if you can have a mechanism, which in this case is sexual recombination, which means that genes could be recombined, you create a new genetic types so that can be more effective fighting against these diseases, and you will stay ahead. But when you stay ahead, you turn to be successful and become popular, and you make a lot of offspring, and then the parasites and pathogens will readapt to you. So basically, you are the victim of your own success. So the cycle goes on again, and sex provides exactly the genetic diversity needed to keep this cycle going on.
I absolutely love the term evolutionary arms race. This just really brings it into focus. I want to circle back to something Lynn had brought up about, we really kind of just think of just male and female as the two fundamental categories. I guess I want to know, how universal is this binary thinking about life on Earth, and what should it really tell us about our success rate or maybe lack thereof?
Yeah, lots of things we don't understand. Males and females are defined biologically by gamete size. Males produce sperm and females produce eggs. But the problem is, as we understand now, is that we don't need a direct reproduction to pass on our genes. Lots of situations, we just contribute to the genetic relatives so that our genes will perpetuate, which also means even without direct reproduction, we can still be evolutionarily successful. And that cannot be better illustrated by these ants, wasps, and bees. More than 90% of these bee colonies, for example, are non-sexual and non-reproductive, and they never do reproduce by themselves. They simply work their neck off until they die by helping the queen to reproduce, helping the colony to be successful. And they themselves do not reproduce at all. Think about it, more than 90% of individuals do not do reproduction at all by themselves. And they are hugely successful. If you look at the ants alone, 30,000 species in the world, they are everywhere. And from the mountaintop to all the lowest area, except the ocean, for example, except the highly frigid area, freezing area, or the area without water at all, and they are everywhere. They biomass, they are collectively, in terms of biomass, they are more than all the wildlife, mammals and birds, wildlife of mammals and birds combined. They are such a hugely successful group, and vast number of them do not reproduce directly, and simply by helping the queens to successful and they carry, let the genes prevail generation over generation.
It's a weird and wonderful science of reproduction. Dr. Li Xing Sun is our guest, and his book is called On the Origin of Sex. This is really has been fascinating, and it makes us think about our own existence and our own reproduction. Li Xing, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you so much, Lynn and Scott. It's a nice conversation. We could go on for hours.
We certainly could.